Welcome to another inspirational message from Hillsong Church, London.
I've noticed that there's two things that in the Bible that I think are vitally important. One is your revelation of who Jesus is. Now, I know I've said this before, but somebody did encourage me once to say, you know, when you're sick of saying it, they're only just hearing it. So is the revelation of whom Jesus is and what that's all about could have a dramatic impact on your life. The second revelation is the revelation of the church. Sometimes the second revelation or the second understanding is a lot of the time completely dismissed in people's lives. And it's all about Jesus, except the thing that we have got to understand, Jesus said, he said, I'm going to build my church. So if the thing that Jesus said that he's going to get about, which is the church, then our understanding of the church probably is linked to our own personal well-being in our, what we might term our Christian growth. Do you get what I'm trying to say? And often, you know, about the best way I can describe it is if I've got my left leg, let's call that, that's my understanding of Jesus. My right leg is my understanding of the church. If I get both of them in balance, because I believe that one of the big challenges that I want to put out to us as a church, and I'm not necessarily saying that this is, that I'm addressing something wrong, but a challenge to actually really highlight this, that the message of the church and the behavior of the church should be congruent. And sometimes if we're not careful, the message of the church is one thing and the behaviors of the church are another thing. And you've just got to follow through the history of the church over the last 2,000 years to witness that and to see that. And often when you then get into, if you study church history and you look at some of the absolutely whacked behavior of the church, you can actually link it back to the whacked revelation and the moving away from the whom Jesus of the Bible was and the introduction of whom the Jesus in the religion is. And now we have this behavior that is somewhat warped. Do you get what I'm trying to say? And so the importance is because if this is my revelation of Jesus, this is my revelation of the church, I'm supposed to walk. Now we use Christian terms like my spiritual walk. We talk about it's a journey. It's all of those sorts of things. But really, what we're talking about the progress of our lives, and the progress of our lives as Christians is the progress of Christ Jesus working his way into the who I am as a person. Right, so that's what my walk is all about. That's what the transformational thing about Christianity is all about. We're not instantly transformed. I was this, now I am this. It is a process. Transformation is a process, and that is linked to this walking it out. And as I learn to more and more trust in the whom Jesus is, trust in the whom he is at work in my life, the more and more I live my life out, the more and more my life begins to reflect the whom he is to me, as opposed to who the old one of me was. So our Christian walk, if I use that term, we're supposed to be progressing. We're supposed to be moving forward. Now, if this, my revelation of church, is stagnant, then, and this is doing all right, all I'll end up doing, if I'm not careful, is this. And if you look at your life, it can somewhat become, everything's just like a reoccurring theme. Just walking in circles, just repeating the same old cycle over and over. And just as if I end up with the wrong revelation of Jesus and I get caught up into the religious side of what church is, and I'm so focused on what that's all about, I'll end up walking around in religious circles. And it's just a reoccurring theme when I'm supposed to be actually progressing, and we use the term growing and all of those sorts of things. So the revelation of these two things, I think, is important. And so our revelation of the church, our revelation is, or let's put it this way, our perspective of the church, meaning the way we see it. How do I see church? How I see it will determine how I engage it. What's my ultimate perspective of it? And if we're not careful, that the way we see it can affect the way it impacts our lives. If I see it the right way, it'll impact my life the right way. If I see it the wrong way, it'll impact my life the wrong way. And so if we remember that the how we see things is determined by will determine how we engage things in life. Now that's pretty much true for so many different things, but they're often built on perceptions. What's our perception of something? If we understand, once again, this is a little bit going over old ground a couple of weeks ago, but a perception is as reality. How you perceive things to be is how they will be to you. And regardless of what it really is, it's how it will be to you because you perceive it that way, and it determines how you engage things. And our perceptions are set by things like, this is what I was told. This is what I've heard. This is what was labeled. This is what I've labeled. You know, we can have perceptions of ourselves that are incorrect because things that we've heard and we take on board, things that we've been told we take on board, labels that we have been given that we take on board, labels that we give ourselves that we take on board, shape a perception of ourselves that ultimately influence the way we live our lives. Now, in the same way, the what we've heard about church, what we've been told about church, what's been labeled about church, what label we've given it, has the same impact on our lives. Yeah? And so just really quickly, just going through things, it's so what comes to your mind when I say the word church? Is it an institution? Is it an organization? Is it a building? Is it something that just exists for me? What's it going to do for me? What benefit is it to me? It's here to help me. It's here to fix me. It should be doing something for me. Is church the thing that's supposed to get behind you? And if we're not careful, if those are the things that you, how you see it, then you're always going to be in trouble because the church is never going to get behind you. Yes, it will help you. Yes, the message of the church and the behavior of the church hopefully puts you in a position where the term fix you, if whatever that's applicable, that all happens. But if you see it as that, you're always in a place where what my hand is out asking for it to do something for me, because we simply just see it as a social institution that is there to be there for my whim and my every need. And I think we got to be careful of that. Jesus introduced the term church. Matthew chapter 16, verse 17. And what did he say to Peter? Peter, in a dialogue with Peter, and he asked Peter, so who do people say that I am? And Peter named, well, you are. That's what they say. You are these things. He listed two or three things. Then Jesus comes back at him with another question, but Peter, who do you say I am? So it's not necessarily about what is other people saying about me. What's most important is what do you say about me? How do you see me? And so then what does Peter do? Peter says, well, you are the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. After that, Jesus then responds. He says, blessed are you, Simon. And then he goes on, gives him a new name, Peter, meaning there's going to be something, instead of something flimsy about you and life, where you go from one whim to the next whim, there is going to be something solid about you. And now you're called Peter, meaning rock. And then he says, upon this rock, I will build my church. Now we've got to make sure it's not, we're not upon Peter, he built the church. Right? It's not, that's not what he said he's going to build on. He says, upon this rock. And what was the rock? This Peter's revelation, a personal revelation of whom Jesus is, and a revelation that came to him, revealed to him by God. A personal revelation, a personal encounter with God, a relationship with God, not a belief in a distant God who is uncaring, not a belief in a distant God who doesn't engage the human life, but the belief in a God and a faith in a God that comes into a relationship with a God who wants to be deeply personal with the individual. He says, upon this, I'll build my church, meaning the church, meaning the gathering together of all of those people who have that personal revelation of whom Jesus is, the revelation that Jesus is the incarnate of a selfless God who came to make a way for human beings to enter into a relationship with this selfless God. And in turn, as he influences them, starting a transformational process on the inside, the more they live a selfless existence, meaning the way they see other people, the way they interact with other people, the way they view other people from the perspective of how am I going to treat them, what am I going to do for them, the more I engage in a selfless existence modeled by Jesus, the more I become like him. Do you get right? And so that church is the gathering together of those people. We get together as those people, and it's called, and that's what the church is. People who are called out of darkness, I don't know God, called into light, I do know God. I know him at a personal level. That's the church. And so if we, as just moving forward, what I want to do is just look at some of the different aspects, you might say, of the church, and look at some of the things that I think we could learn, some of the things that maybe can have a tremendous impact on our lives. And not only that, I think some of the things that potentially can have an impact on society and make a difference in the world in which we live. So let's get into it, right? So let me read here from Acts chapter 2, all right? And this is going to be a basis of message over a period of over a few weeks. And it says here, if I started in verse 41, we'll start there. It says, those who believed what Peter said were baptized and added to the church that day, about 3,000 in all. And then it goes on and it says, all the believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship. Now, devoted just simply means they gave themselves wholeheartedly to this. All right, that's what it means. It wasn't, they weren't half in. There was, I am in this. I'm devoted to this. And it's interesting, it says, they devoted themselves, the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, sharing in meals, including the Lord's Supper, and to prayer. You know, just the prayer thing, just last Sunday, I think it was in one of the services. And it really, for me, really highlighted just how important this, you know, this little time where we say, well, we're going to come together as a church and we pray. And, you know, we do exactly the same. Have you noticed we do exactly the same thing every week? You noticed, right? I know. It's just repetitive. You could call it traditional, which is probably more what it is. Part of the culture of the way we do things is we take a moment in our service and we're going to pray for someone. Now, you could look at that and go, you could come to it and you can say, well, hey, I'm actually a part of this. Or you could be there and go, oh, here we go again. This is what we're going to do. God's going to come on. He's going to go, ah! Then he's going to read out this. Then he's going to read out this. We're going to pray. And he's going to go, and then we're going to go back into a song. There it is. Or you could go, hey, something powerful is happening here. This is something awesome. And a young guy reminded me this of last week where he'd come up at the end of the service and he said, do you remember me? Now, you've got to remember how many people will come get in my face in one day, let alone. And I looked at him and I went, yeah, actually I do, but you need to give me some context. I don't remember why I remember you, but I do remember your face. And he said, well, about a year ago or sometime, he said, in prayer time, I asked you to pray for something for me. I said, oh, cool. And he said, I asked you to pray for my mother. My mother was sick. She's an elderly lady. She was sick in hospital in Chennai in India. And she was about to undergo an operation. I'm going to get the people at Hillsong to pray for you, Mum, in hospital. And you prayed with me. And at the same time you prayed with me, as she's going in the next day for her operation, of which was sort of highly important, it was like, oh, this doesn't need to happen anymore because she's all okay. She's healed. Now, I sit there and I go, now, I don't know about you, but I go, wow. Like, that's in Chennai in India. Like, I get, come here, I'll pray for you here now. But here we are in this moment that if we're not careful, we can just dismiss the importance of it. And in dismissing the importance of it, miss out on the power of it in what is happening. And that's why often when I got all excited, I thought, come on, you've renewed faith in saying, make sure you tell someone, we as a church are going to pray for them, because God can travel countries and we can see great things happen because he wants to. And there's something that is linked to the prayer of faith. There's something that is linked to us praying. There is something that is linked to our devotion to praying about things that sees things happen. And I think there's things as we get into this, looking at the church, that our devotion to certain things will produce God results. Right now, as I started reading this, we've got to remember this is the beginning of the church. We've got to make sure how we see it. I want to remind you, and I'm going to say it over and over and over. Is this, how do you see this as I read it? Is it what it really is the catalyst formation of the Church of Jesus Christ that has prevailed over 2,000 years? Out of a small group of people, now is all over the world. And 2,000 years later, it is still a part of most societies on the planet. Whether it be the good, whether it be bad, whether it be ugly, it still exists. Now that's extraordinary. It's amazing. So is it the catalyst, the beginning? Is it the formation of the church? Or do you just dismiss it as the early church? See, when you dismiss it as the early church, you give yourself license to actually say, well, actually things have moved on. And I hear people say, well, things have moved on. I hear people say, hey, the gifts of the Spirit. You tell the lady in Chennai that God healed, that the gifts of the Spirit finished in the early church. I'm not sure she's going to believe you. Hey, we don't believe in speaking in tongues because that was for the early church. Well, just maybe. Well, I speak in tongues and I wasn't around then and I might look like I was, but I wasn't around then, but I speak in tongues now. But see, it all stopped in the early church, didn't it? No. Well, because see, if you look at it as the early church, what you're allowed to do with that, with the word now, is you're actually allowed to bring the word into your theology. You're allowed to bring the word into what you believe. You're allowed to take it and line it up with what you see as truth. If you see it as the foundation and the formation, you say, hey, I'm going to line up what I think with this. I'm going to line up my theology with this. I'm going to line up what, I'm going to find out what truth is by looking at this. I'm going to line my truth up with this truth as opposed to manipulating it so it lines up with my truth. It gives you all sorts of license if you see it as this is the early church. But if you see it as the formation, then there's lots of things that I think we can learn in it, right? And so it goes on. So he says he devoted to these four things. And then reading on, it says, and a deep sense of awe came over all the apostles. They performed many miraculous signs and wonders, and all the believers met together in one place and shared everything they had. They sold their property and their possessions, and they shared the money with those in need. They worshiped together in the temple. Each day they met in homes for the Lord's Supper, and they shared meals with great joy and generosity, all the while praising God and enjoying the goodwill of the people. And each day the Lord added to their fellowship those that were being saved. Each day the Lord added to their fellowship those that were being saved. Now, when you read that and you look at that, there's a few, I guess, a few observations that you can draw from it. And I want to focus on one observation today, all right? Because there's plenty that you can draw out from it. There was an incredibly high relational aspect to what these people were about. There was a community. There was a sense of a sense of family. If you were to maybe look at the culture of the day, most people saw things like family. Now, you've got to remember, we live in a big urban city. A lot of people say that this big urban city is one of the loneliest cities in the world. Usually big urban cities, people move to urban environments for all sorts of things. They move to urban environments because they're a work transfer. They move to urban environments because I don't want to live in this small anymore, because I want a sense of anonymity. And when I'm seeking that anonymity, I'll go to a bigger environment. Yet the funny thing is then they form, well, then people form communities. But there's this sense of, I want to be known where I want to be known, but I don't want to be known where I don't want to be known. Whether it's people move to a big urban environment because they want to see their lives go forward. But for a lot of times, people move to urban environments, and when it comes to family, and family is not here. And where church has the potential to actually be family for people. And so if we go back culturally in this time, that culturally the sense of family, or what family was, the sense of the community that you were a part of. And that's why when Robbie was talking, he says, you know, there's lots of, we use the term different communities within inside our church, where inside that, hopefully you find a sense of family. Now, culturally, what these guys back then, how they saw things was, I belong to this and this belongs to me. They saw family as much as a part of who they were as how they saw them as a part of family. They saw the community as much a part of me as I am of this. You get what I'm trying to say? Now, what's interesting, if you look in the Bible in Romans chapter 12 and verses 3 to 5, if we just have a look at it and read it, there's something interesting that comes up here. And so Paul picks up and he says, because of the privilege and authority God has given me, I give each of you this warning. Don't think yourself better than you really are. In other words, he's just saying, just have an attitude of humility. That as good as you think you are, according to your religious criteria, you're really not that good. Now, even the best person in this room right now, if you were to have here's the 10 things that I think have got to be perfect to get score points with God. Even the best person in the room is lucky to get an 8 out of 10 consistently. The average person in the room might get 8 out of 10 every now and again, and 2 out of 10 most times, if we're real. Right now, I know some of you go, oh, no, that's not me. I'm perfect. Yeah, I could ask a few people to know you and maybe it wouldn't come up like that. But anyway, so So he's just sort of says, you know, just to have the right perspective, because he gives us the context of the right perspective. Be honest in your evaluation of yourselves, measuring yourselves by the faith God has given us, right? So in measurement to what does faith bring into our lives, meaning faith, we put our faith in the finished work of Jesus. In putting our faith in the finished work of Jesus, he looks at us as if everything is okay. So just make sure that you don't translate into, I know he looks at me as if everything's okay. Don't be arrogant enough to stand there and say, and everything is okay, because that's what he's talking about, right? So then he goes on and he says this, just as our bodies have many parts and each part a special function. Now he's talking about a body so that we might understand how the church works together. He says, so look at your body. Study your body, look at how that works. That's pretty much all he's saying. And he says, it has many parts, each part a special function. Meaning, every single person in this room has got a special function to play in the body of Christ. Now, whether you do or you don't is up to you, but I think sometimes our do or our don't has all got to do with how we see the church. And if we see the church as just something that I just attend or whatever it might be, and we actually miss out on actually discovering what our special function is. And then he goes on, he says, so it is with Christ's body. We are many parts of one body and we all belong to each other. Now, the concept in today's world, all right, to actually say that you belong to someone? Oh my goodness. That is in our Western culture, to actually say that you as a human being belong to somebody else, that's like, oh, whoa, dude. You don't know. No, I am known, I am owned by nobody. You don't. That's such a foreign concept. But to actually be in a position, and this is culturally where these people were, and I think we can learn from something from this, right? Because culturally they saw what they were a part of and what was as much a who they were as they were in it. It was as much them as it was. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Yet this whole concept of belonging is something that is so foreign to us in our Western thinking, as I said, that it's actually seen as an affront. You know, little things like, your children don't belong to you. It's like, really? Well, who told you my children don't belong to you? Well, school. Now, if you're a school teacher, school principal, relax. I'm not banging on you. But, you know, I was in a conversation 2 days ago and one of the people was saying, oh, you know, what is this about, you know, school holidays or, you know, you can't take your kids out of school because, sorry, I'm not having a go. I'm not trying to change policy. I'm not, just hear it for what I'm trying to say, because I'm going to get into trouble for saying this and I'm prepared to. So, all right. But here, the point that I'm trying to make, right? You can't take your kids out of school if it's not school holidays. Yeah, but if you've got kids and you want to go on holidays, do you notice that the airlines hike the prices and the holiday places hike the prices? Everyone hikes the prices. So no one can afford to go on holidays in school holidays. So you try and take your kid out of school to go on school holidays on a holiday that you can afford, but you can't do that because you're going to get fined an extraordinary amount of money because you took your kids on a holiday. But see, they're not your kids because nobody belongs to anybody today. In fact, they're the state's kids and the state. Now, I'm just trying to highlight the concept of where things are at in society. I'm not trying to change the law. My kids are grown up, so it doesn't bother me anymore. So, right? But just the concept of this belonging thing. And so this this whole sense of culturally, this community thing was amazing. And you know, because if you look at the things that they did, as you read this through Acts, all right, it says that they gathered together for a common meal, right? They and it says that they're so, and including the Lord's Supper. It says, and the Lord added to their fellowship daily those that have been saved. That's the relational aspect of what's going on here when it comes to the church, right? In this here, in the observation. Now, what's interesting, if you were to look at, and just a prelude for next time I speak, but if you were to look at this whole concept of common meal, what it was is basically simply just eating together. All right? Now, which to us eating together, yeah, what does it mean, right? But culturally here, eating together, from my understanding, meant a whole lot. And that's why, as we move forward, that's why I'm trying to say, you know, as a church, every other week we all have dinner together. And that just is in groups. So the focus isn't groups. I want the focus as our church is we have dinner together, because there's something powerful in this when you get right into. So the significance of all of this, the eating together thing, just real quick, if you look at it, it's the amount of times that food was referenced and Jesus was eating with people. All right, for example, I think it was in the book of Luke, it's mentioned 31 times that there's this sense of eating together. Interesting, if you were to look in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 to 11, there's this confrontation with the religious towards Jesus because of whom he was eating with. And it's amazing the accusations here it is talking to the disciples. Why does the master or why does Jesus eat with such scum? All right? That word reference. And what he's talking about is here's Jesus and he's just having dinner with anybody. Everyone was invited, anybody who was allowed to come there. And you see the confrontations as you get into reading these accounts. And the confrontations came because the concept of eating together symbolized a number of things to this generation. And one was is that when you eat with someone, what you're saying is we are friends forever. So now here's Jesus eating with all these people that don't qualify according to religious law to be accepted, yet here's Jesus eating with people who don't qualify, saying that we're friends forever. And it's amazing how this whole concept of the common law was a common meal, I should say, is almost like as Jesus is introducing it in a different concept, he's introducing this whole new world order that he's going to bring in. And the new world order is the inclusiveness of everybody can fit into the family of God, because I'm going to make a way so that everybody can be included. Because the only way that you can get included into the family of God these days is by putting your faith in Jesus Christ, whom being, as I said at the start, God being a selfless God who is relational, enters into humanity in a selfless way, in human form, lives a selfless life, dies a selfless death on our behalf so that we can come into a relationship with this selfless God and be included, every single human being. And so when Jesus is sitting down having dinner with people, he's saying, hey, is essentially saying, I am bringing in a whole new social order. I'm setting up a new way. I'm setting up an inclusiveness of things. And in a sense, it's almost like he was demonstrating the grace of God. Anybody can come and sit at my table because I'm going to make a way for anybody to be able to come sit at it. And so this whole common meal thing is this getting together and this demonstration of this acceptance thing. Now, all of this, what I'm saying, there's a stark contrast to this cultural thing, and I know I've just been banging away at it, but hopefully you're getting the picture, right? Is in the world that we live in today, the contrast is individualism's rampant in the world that we live in today. This sense of individualistic spirit that is almost in complete contrast to what this is taking place here at a biblical foundation, right? At a fundamental level. It's not something we're supposed to have moved on. It's something that should be a part of the whom we are, the way we conduct our lives, this relational aspect of Christianity. Now, when we use the term individualism, you've got to remember individualism is a social theory that was born as things began to change in feudal, if we use the term feudal England, because that's where we are, where the lords and the serfs thing was dealt with, where human rights, there was a point where the serfs had no human rights, the only people who had rights were the highborns, and there was the highborns, and there was the plebs, but then suddenly a new social order started to come in where the plebs have rights too, and you can't call people plebs because you can't call people an underclass, although probably it still exists. But anyway, and so it came in to address that. Now the challenge is it has swung so far that individualism has now come down to, which is that come back to, I don't belong to no one. This is my life. I'm going to live my life, my way, for my benefit. That's how individualism plays out. And, you know, just quick definition, individuals promote the exercise of one's goals and desires and so value independence and self-reliance while opposing external influence on one's own interests by society or institutions. Individualism makes the individual the focus rather than the common or the collective interests. See, what's taking place here in this church dynamic that is birthed is complete in contrast to the society that we live in Western culture. Individualism doesn't buy into any philosophy that requires sacrifice of self-interest of the individual for any social cause. So you see this, we've got this complete contrast that's going on. But if we understand this, we enter into a relationship with God who is relational. We enter into, he's selfless. The Bible says he's, what's it talk about God? It says God is love. Right now, God is love, agape love. Not God is love, emotional love. Not God is love, I love you, I have to give you a hug, give you a kiss on the cheek or whatever. God, I love you, I want to get married to you. Not that love, but a love that is almost void of emotion, yet prompts an emotion. Agape love, where this selfless delight in others, a selflessness towards other people. God's love is that. And if you, what does it look like? That's what 1 Corinthians chapter 13 shows us what that looks like. That love, when we encounter that selfless love with God, what it does is it transforms us. We align our lives with Jesus. Jesus is not the standard that we have to attain to. Jesus is the picture of the unshattered, unbroken image of a human in relationship with God. Because of sin, our whole relationship and image of what it looks like for man outside a relationship with God, our whole image is shattered. Yet Jesus is the image of what it looks like to be in perfect relationship with God the Father in his human form. So that, if we're talking about anything, that's what we're headed towards. We're headed towards, that's what it looks like to be in relationship with God, not that's the standard of acceptance, right? And so when we step into this relationship with him, he transforms us from the inside. There's an ultimate promise of this complete transformation that we're going to be completely on that day when the Bible says he returns. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 talks about it, that we're transformed in the twinkling of an eye. The corruptible is left behind. The new is incorruptible. This whole completion of this transformation takes place on that second coming. That's the hope we have with the imperfections that we discover about ourselves and struggle with as we're walking forward, trying to live out this Christian life, trying to express our lives in a selfless way towards other people. One day, all of the struggle and the strain and the imperfection of the broken side of humanity is going to be left behind, and we step into the perfection that Jesus shows us, the perfection of relationship with God. That's the hope we have. That's part of the promise that is coming our way. Do you get what I'm trying to say? So the challenge is, all right, is simply, there's a relational aspect that people are prepared, that they engaged in. Our challenge is, are we prepared to do the same thing? Often we often talk about a sacrificial lifestyle, sacrificial living, and often we term that as, I gave up eating this for the sake of God, or I do. No, sacrificial is I've decided to live selflessly. I've decided to engage in my social environment, be relationally selfless. Now, that doesn't mean I don't get personal benefit. It just means the way I've decided to see other people. And the challenge I want to put out to our church, all right, is this whole concept of we gather together every other week and we have dinner together. That we don't let it get hijacked by someone's preaching point, but it's a gathering together where we get to demonstrate the nature of God, and his nature is selfless towards us, and we get a chance to demonstrate a selflessness towards other people. We get an opportunity to model the grace of God, to portray the grace of God, however, whatever words work for you, where someone can come in and immediately there's no social class, there's no exclusive rules, there's no inclusive laws and behaviors. This is whoever so will may come. This is a new social order. This is that Jesus brought in, and we get a chance to demonstrate that. I think we start to, as a church, behave like that, where our Christianity actually is measured by ability to relate and connect with other people. Not our Christianity is measured by our biblical understanding, not measured by our moral uprightness, but our Christianity is expressed in our towards others. Do you get the spirit of what I'm trying to say? All right. And this dynamic here, this whole relational thing, imagine if we just do every other week as a church, we just have dinner together in homes all over London. Imagine if every other that we had things in the life of the church where it was just purely social. Just what for? Well, so I can come and I can know, get to meet people, get to know people, and no fear of rejection and inclusiveness, no fear of judgment. Not going to get Jesus rammed down your throat. All of those sorts of things. You hearing me? And I just, for us as a church, I believe that this is the challenge. Can we explore this whole thing about the power of the common meal, we getting together, the power of this inclusive social interaction with people? Can we do this? Can we explore this? You know, I was challenged just this week. I was coming out of doing my exercise class. you know, when I told you a story, you know, when I travel, I go, the first thing I do, I sit down, I put my noise cancelling earphones on, take out my Kindle and start reading, which says to the person on my left, to the person on my right, I do not engage in conversation. So I usually give up all the signs. No, this guy does not talk to anybody. So I'm walking out and there's this young guy who was there for his first time, and somehow he walked out at the same time as me and he starts talking to me, and I'm thinking, oh dude, I don't talk. And so I decided I'm a pastor, I should talk. So I started talking, and we must have talked for 5-10 minutes. And in the space of a conversation went 5-10 minutes, this is what he said to me: I'm new to this area. All right? I've just started work at down the road. It was a chiropractic, physiotherapy, massage type place. So, and he said to me 4 times, I've just moved in to the area. I'm new. And I, now, whether it's what he was saying, but it's what I heard, maybe because God was speaking to me. And what I heard was, I'm new to the area and I don't know anybody. And I sat there and I thought, here I am. What I should have been able to say is, hey dude, tonight's Friday. Why don't you come down to this pub just down the corner? I know there's a whole lot of people about your age who just hang out and have drinks in the pub. Some of them think alcohol's bad, so they drink Coke, but anyway, but they go and they just hang out. They're just great people. How about I meet you there, introduce you to a few people. I'm 30 years older than you and them, so I'm going home. All right? You get the spirit of what I'm trying to say? I thought, what if I was able to say that? And then I realized the only thing I could say was, hey, you look like about the same age you should go to Powerhouse. Why don't you go there? They're going to sing these songs that you're going to have no idea what it's about. Then someone's going to talk about Jesus, try and ram him down your throat and say, hey, welcome to getting a new circle of friends. I thought, I can't do that. I should be able to say, I know a whole social network that I can bring you to, introduce you to people, and I promise you, once he meets you, whoever you are, he's probably going to ask, why are you so selfless? Well, it's because of I met Jesus and he's transformed me. I've gone from selfish to selfless. Do you want to meet him too? Do you want to know him? Because that's what he does. Can you imagine if as a church we could do that? You could do that at work. You meet a new work colleague, you come to work and say, what are, most times at work, people that you work with are your competitors. They're the people who are trying to take you out, make sure you don't get promoted so they get promoted and all that. And so most people who move into a city like this, the only people they meet are people that individualism says you meet people to use people, network with people, use them to get ahead, mutual benefit. No, not mutual benefit, my benefit. We live in this age where it's all about how can I get to know you to use you? But we go, hey, get to know everyone. Why don't you come? I know a whole lot of people. You might be 50 and you go, hey, I don't want to be friends with you, but I know a whole lot of people who you might want to be friends with, because I'm 50. You don't want to be friends with me anyway. Or you get a chance to point people in the right direction. Can you imagine if we could get this relational dynamic for what it means from everything from a spiritual level just to meeting the needs of people in a city like London? I just think it would be absolutely amazing. But it's going to take all of us to say, we're in on this, we own this. Amen? Fantastic. Why don't you just jump to your feet?
This is the end of this podcast. We hope you have been challenged and inspired. For more information about Hillsong Church London, please visit hillsong.co.uk.